I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome back to Radio Times. House Bill 1948 is on hold in the Pennsylvania legislature after being on a fast track in the last week and after generating lots of controversy and criticism. The author, Representative Kathy Rapp, introduced the legislation that would ban abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy, except in the case of medical emergencies, and would ban a procedure called dilation and evacuation that's referred to as abortion dismemberment in the bill. She's chair of the House Pro-Life Caucus and said she authored the bill to prevent fetal pain. The Pennsylvania Medical Society has objected to the bill, and the American Congress of Obstetrics and Gynecology said the restrictions represent legislative interference at its worst that could result in lesser care to patients. We're going to talk about this bill that is on hold in Harrisburg in this hour of Radio Times. We have four guests who have joined us, and we begin our conversation with Michael Geer. He's the founding president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Family Institute. Michael Geer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Great to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. What is the scientific, the medical evidence that a 20-week-old fetus feels pain as we would feel pain as whatever age you are?
Well, let me start off first by saying I appreciate the opportunity to be on the radio with you there in Philadelphia, which I would kind of describe as a tale of two cities. Within a mile and a half of each other is 3801 Lancaster Avenue, which is where the Kermit Gosnell Women's Medical Society was located, where late-term abortions were happening regularly without any state inspection, despite the knowledge of the state and despite the knowledge of local physicians and the Philadelphia Department of Health. That atrocity was allowed to continue for decades.
And he is in prison, we should say to our listeners, yes.
But just down the street, a mile and a half away, is Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, the leading children's hospital, I would say, in the world, especially leading in the area of doing surgery on unborn children, on these babies, fetal surgery as early as 18 weeks on things like spina bifida, where anesthesia is routinely administered. You know, Marty, back until the late 1980s, they did not administer anesthesia routinely to infants that had been born, newborns. They did surgery on those without any anesthesia whatsoever. And physicians and scientists have recognized that, wait a minute, something's wrong here. The ability to feel pain, the physiological impact of that pain, even whether or not it registers in a way that science can measure in terms of what's happening at that present moment, could cause psychological damage in the future, et cetera. So
let me just stop you there, only because our time is limited. Sure. According to the Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, also the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, based on fetal development, their conclusion is that a fetus does not in any way begin to feel pain until after 24 weeks because of the development process. It's the pain receptors are not connected, if I can use a very unscientific word.
But those would have been the same institutions in all likelihood that until the 1980s were okay with the operations on born children who were outside the womb, newborn infants who they routinely did not provide anesthesia to because they didn't think that was a problem either. And you know, what we're seeing there at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia is when they're doing fetal surgery, they are applying anesthesia to both patients, to the mother and to the baby that's inside the womb, because of a recognition that even if they're not 100% sure, isn't it better to not inflict pain on a live human being? And that's what this legislation is all about. If there's even some doubt as to whether it's, 24 weeks, 23 weeks, 22 weeks, if we're doubting whether we're inflicting pain, well, let's not inflict the pain. And that's one part of what this legislation is about.
Well,
and the other part of it, Marty,
I do want to talk about that. Yes, indeed.
Is the shift in fetal viability. New England Journal of Medicine had a report that was issued just last May that said fetal viability is shifting much earlier. It was, at the time that the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act that was passed in 1989, a quarter century ago, viability was not considered until 25 weeks, so pretty much at the earliest. The New England Journal of Medicine is saying that substantial numbers of babies born at 22 weeks are able to survive outside the womb if they're given medical treatment. So we're trying to, this legislation, I think, is trying to keep up with the advances in science, both in terms of pain science as well as understanding of the humanity of the human being that's inside the womb. And certainly if they can live outside the womb, we shouldn't be intervening and ending their life prematurely.
Let me quote something from the New York Times, which looked at that study that you just referenced. The Times said the study of thousands of premature births found that a tiny minority of babies born at 22 weeks who were medically treated survived with few health problems, although the vast majority died or suffered serious health issues. Are you saying the definition of viability is a small percentage of fetuses surviving at 22 weeks, that should be the definition of viability?
Well, number one, that New York Times quotes that's from the study. But part of the reason that study, those numbers, those percentages are so tiny is because in many hospitals, they don't provide any treatment to babies that are born before 24 weeks. When they're born at 22 weeks, the doctors basically say they're not going to be viable anyway. They don't offer any treatment whatsoever. The percentage was significantly higher when treatment was provided to those babies. So if you look at just the sample size of those who did receive treatment, that number was much higher. Did they have difficulties and challenges? Yes. But everybody in life, whether they're born as quote-unquote normal, has difficulties and challenges in life. That doesn't make them any less valuable as a human being. And that's part of what needs to be discussed here and considered as we consider this law and the fact that in many states in the United States, abortion is permitted throughout all 9 months of pregnancy. You know, Marty, the United States of America is one of only 7 countries in the world that allow abortions after 20 weeks. Among those other 7 are North Korea and China and Vietnam. That's not a community we want to be a part of. Most of Europe prohibits abortions after 12 weeks. So, The debate gets on these nuances of, can angels dance on a head of a pin? You know, at what specific day and hour do they feel pain versus can't we all agree that dismembering unborn children, dismembering a live human being, tearing them limb from limb in the womb so they bleed to death before they're extracted from the womb is not a humane thing to do? And number two, can't we at least move in the direction that Europe has done and most of the civilized world and say that these late-term abortions shouldn't be permitted at all?
Well, we are talking about abortions at, prohibiting abortions under most circumstances in after 20 weeks, which would be in the second trimester, and also banning this procedure, dilation and evacuation. There were 3 women who spoke earlier in this week about the fact that they had abortions after 20 weeks, including using this procedure. One woman named Kelsey Williams, this was a planned pregnancy, something that she and her family and her husband wanted. They found from an ultrasound at 20 weeks that this unborn son, as it turned out, had a debilitating bone and muscle disorder and probably would not have survived outside the womb, and made this painful decision to have an abortion. If this were passed, this woman, Kelsey Williams, would not have been able to have that procedure. Are you comfortable with that?
Well, we do know that lethal anomalies that exist with the unborn child, like that one that you described, which I don't know any detail about it beyond what was said at that press conference. Whether we decide that life should be terminated late in a pregnancy is something that should be debated. But the fact is that many fetal anomalies can be dealt with through surgeries. The vast majority of fetal anomalies, whether it's spina bifida, as we've talked about, or heart defects like a hole between the ventricles in the heart, or cleft palate, or other things, those are fetal anomalies that can be dealt with, and the child that lives as a result will live with a high quality of life. And so, there's hundreds of these late-term abortions that took place in Pennsylvania, according to the Department of Health, in 2014. And those are heart-wrenching circumstances that were described in that press conference. But if the child is, if the determination is the child's going to die anyway, the question is it best to go in and intervene and cause the death, a painful death, early through an abortion or through natural death That
well, let me intervene here. I mean, the question is who decides? And in this case, this was a woman who decided with her husband and with her medical professional that this was in the best interest of this particular woman and this family. And it sounds like also with best particular interests of this son who had to have his life terminated.
But just before I got on the phone with you, Marty, I talked to an obstetrician gynecologist on the main line who's practiced for more than 20 years, delivers 300 babies a year. He did his residency at Hahnemann Hospital, where they delivered hundreds of babies a month. He has encountered these circumstances, and his counsel would be different. The fact is that what we're really talking about is the numbers of babies in our society, that these late-term babies that are aborted, hundreds of them here in Pennsylvania every year, past the date of viability, past the time when they can certainly feel pain, where they're killed inhumanely through abortion, just because someone decides that they're not going to have a quality of life that we deem worthwhile. 90% of Down syndrome babies are killed, yet they have a wonderful quality of life. Yes, there are challenges that come with all of those things, but you know, I've raised five teenagers, and there are challenges in every circumstance in life. And for us to decide that there's a strong line of demarcation of these human beings are worthy of life and these are not, is not where I think we should be as a society. And this legislation, House Bill 1948, is designed to at least bring us up with the science and add some humanity to the way abortion is considered in the United States of America here in Pennsylvania.
And about a minute before I have to say goodbye to you, Michael Geer, what do you say, though, to the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology saying that this bill represents legislative interference at its worst and could result in lesser care to patients? And that would, of course, be to the mother in this instance.
Well, I think the first thing I'd say is having worked in Harrisburg, a state capital, where there are lots of interest groups, if you will, including those that purport to represent large numbers of people in professions, it's actually a small number of people that make the decisions to put statements out like that. And I think there's a vast number of physicians across the state, including the one I talked to on the phone this morning, that would beg to differ with them. And there's certainly politics at play when big organizations like that come out with statements like that that I think should be discounted.
Including the Pennsylvania Medical Society, which also objected to the bill?
Well, again, I guess that I would say absolutely. I think that their physicians, we always talk about in medicine, get a second opinion, and let me just leave it at that.
Well, Michael Geer, thank you so much for getting our conversation started.
You're welcome.
And he's founding president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Family Institute. The first of four guests in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about Pennsylvania House Bill 1948. It is on hold, giving us some time to talk about what it is. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Just a recap here. Lawmakers in Harrisburg are considering tightening restrictions on abortions, outlawing them after 20 weeks, except in rare occasions, banning a commonly used procedure to end pregnancy. Supporters say they want to prevent fetal pain. And they also raise questions about viability. This controversial legislation, HB 1948, is now in limbo. The governor said he would veto it if given the chance. We just said goodbye to Michael Geer, president of the Pennsylvania Family Institute. Joining us now is Angela Columbus, who covers Pennsylvania state government for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Angela, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So where does HB 1948, where does it stand today?
Well, like you said, it's on a legislative hold. What happened was that it was formally introduced a couple of weeks ago fairly late in the day on a Friday. And then after that, it picked up with lightning speed. By Monday, it was in a House committee, the House Health Committee, and it passed out of there. And then it got positioned for an actual floor vote within a few days, which anybody who follows Harrisburg will tell you that rarely happens, particularly on these types of very controversial pieces of legislation. After that, it was slated to come up for a vote this past Monday, right, and suddenly just fell off the face of the legislative earth, legislative map. And that happened after the press conference that you mentioned earlier and speaking with Michael Gear, where Governor Wolf and other elected officials got to, and Planned Parenthood got together with these three mothers who shared their stories about why this type of procedure is so important to remain legal in Pennsylvania.
And looking at this bill, is it largely supported by Republicans and opposed by Democrats, or does it cross some of these party lines, Angela?
It does. I mean, it's largely it's sponsored and it was pushed by the so-called pro-life caucus up here in Harrisburg. And there were actually some Republican sponsors who dropped off, a few of them, not many. But I think that there are legislators on both political sides who would, I guess, define themselves as pro-life. And but I think what kind of put the brakes on this bill was the speed with which it was moving. What happened here, and a lot of even pro-life legislators privately will tell you, is they felt uncomfortable with the fact that, unlike this discussion here today, there wasn't even a public hearing on this bill to hear from both sides of the argument.
So what happens next, or is that anyone's guess at this point?
It really is. I mean, usually in a general election year like this one, I hate to be so crass, but you don't see this type of bill come up, at least prior to a general election. There is always that possibility. But as it stands now, I think it would be, some people think it's politically risky to bring up a bill that the governor has said he will veto. And for which there is no guarantee that the Senate would pass, even if it passed the House.
Well, Angela, we're going to end our conversation on that note. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times and getting us up to speed on this particular bill.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And again, that's Angela Columbus, writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and she covers Pennsylvania state government. Joining us now is Anne Honeybrink. She is vice chair of the regional branch of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and she has been listening in since the top of the hour. And Anne Honeybrink, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And let me just give out the phone number to our listeners, which is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me pick up on a couple of things I put to Michael Gear. This bill, according to the supporters, designed to protect a fetus from feeling pain during a particular abortion procedure. Can you respond to that?
Sure, I can. I think there have been two fairly extensive reviews of the scientific literature to date that have shown that there is not the connection yet between the peripheral nerves and the fetal cortex, where the cortex of the brain where pain would be felt before at least 24 weeks and probably even later in gestation. And to answer his comment about using anesthesia,
I was just going to ask that. Yes, go ahead.
That is not so much to help the patient, the fetus, from feeling pain, because we don't think the fetus can feel pain, but they do react to any kind of stimulus, pleasant or not. And one thing you don't want a fetus or a person to be doing when you're operating on them is to move. So really it's more to control movement and be able to do surgery more accurately, which is much easier to do, believe me, on one who is still, that is the reason for the anesthesia, not really because of perception of pain.
The supporters of this bill, they're talking about this particular procedure, dilation and evacuation, as dismemberment. Can you walk us through D&E?
Well, D&E, the D&E stands for dilation, which means opening up the cervix, and evacuation. And evacuation usually refers to when there is a fetus inside the uterus or an embryo earlier in pregnancy. And there are varying techniques that depend on the age of the fetus at the time the procedure is done. Often, the attempt is made to remove the fetus intact, but because of the anatomy of the uterus and the cervix, that may not be possible. So at times, fetal parts are removed before removing the whole baby, or the rest of the fetus, I'm sorry. And it's a horrible thing to think about. It's not the way anyone would want a procedure to be done if there were another option. But that, in fact, is the best option for the health of the mother. We've shown over time that that method is safer for the mother than other methods that have been used in the past for terminating a pregnancy after the second trimester. So things like making the mother go into labor really are more dangerous for the mom than a DNA.
Well, let me pick up on that. Let's say this procedure was banned in Pennsylvania. What are the options that a woman or a physician like yourself would have if someone wanted to have an abortion?
Well, there are potential ways around that procedure on a live baby. A procedure can be done prior to the DNA, where basically the fetus is given potassium or another substance that makes the baby's heart stop beating, so the baby is no longer viable when the procedure is done. There are the use of prostaglandin suppositories that will make the cervix dilate and eventually the baby delivers, similar to labor and delivery. But all of those are more dangerous for the mom than the current procedure is.
Why is that?
Because they're just I can tell you reasons why, but the main reason why is because when we've compared different methods in scientific studies, the complication rate for the mother is higher. Infection afterwards is higher with other types of procedures where you basically induce labor than it is with DNA.
And that's Ann Honeybrink, vice chair of the regional branch of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the third of four guests in this hour of Radio Times, talking about a bill that's on hold now in Harrisburg would outlaw abortions after 20 weeks, except for under unusual circumstances, or I should say emergency conditions. Also ban a common procedure we've been talking about, DNE. And again, Ann Honeybrink telling us why she is opposed to this legislation. We heard from a supporter earlier in the hour. And we'd like to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And let me go back to something that Michael Gear and I were talking about. And this is a report from the New England Journal of Medicine, came out about a year ago. I'm back to the New York Times, so I'll just quote here. A 2014 summary of a workshop that involved the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the American Academy of Pediatrics said that, quote, in general, those born at 23 weeks of gestation should be considered potentially viable, unquote, because more than a quarter of such babies survive when treated intensively. The report said nothing helps babies born at less than 22 weeks to survive. So we are back at the point of trying to figure out, well, what is viability? How should we understand that?
Well, I think there are many different ways to look at viability, and one of the things I would look at when we're looking at a statistic like that, there's a difference between – first, let's back up a second. The
Sure.
reason that most women would decide to terminate a pregnancy after 20 weeks is not – because they don't want to be pregnant. It's generally the types of stories you referred to earlier, where an anomaly that's incompatible with life is diagnosed, or an anomaly that would make the baby, once it's born, have a very difficult and painful life. And those are the reasons why women have terminations in general after 20 weeks, or when a condition is diagnosed that puts the mother's life in danger or that can't be well treated as long as she is still pregnant. So having said that,
right,
there's a difference between the agonizing decisions that need to be made by a couple when, say, the mother goes into preterm labor or ruptures membranes early, and we know the baby will probably need to be born within the next week or two or three. Those kinds of decisions, how to manage that pregnancy and labor and delivery, are very different from the decision-making process with a mom who has a fetus that's been diagnosed with a congenital anomaly. And let me just say that the reasons that women have terminations are not the ones mentioned earlier. Cleft palate is not a common reason for women to have terminations after 24 weeks. That is something, or after 20 weeks. That is something that is easily repaired. But other anomalies such as anencephaly and other abnormalities in the way that the spinal cord is formed, abnormalities in the way the lungs are being formed, absence of the kidneys, all things that are usually diagnosed on ultrasound around that 18 to 20 week range are the common reasons that women and their families decide on termination after 20 weeks. So there's a difference between a baby that is to date healthy in utero and doesn't have an abnormality at 23 weeks and trying to decide how to manage that, and a baby that is 22 weeks with a problem. Does that make sense?
It does. Let me get Kelly from Hopewell to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Kelly. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
It's a little hard. It's hard to talk because it's very painful, but I had a late term abortion 13 years ago to a baby I very much wanted to have, that I still love to this day, still celebrate her birthdays and everything. But, you know, she was diagnosed with a problem, and I also had a problem where she was not getting enough blood. And on top of it, she had a genetic disorder. And we decided to terminate, partly because I was fearful that she was suffering in utero. So you're a little bit damned if you do, damned if you don't. I was in the support group for a while afterwards, and there was a woman whose child had trisomy 13, and she decided to have the baby. And both of us were fearful of the other judging us for our decision because we made different decisions.
Oh my.
And in the end, we became very close. Because we realized that, you know, we just went through something horrible that there was no right answer to.
Well, Kelly, we can hear it in your voice. We are in total empathy with your struggle with this issue and the obvious kind of pain that you felt. Let me see what Ann Honeybrink says. I heard her kind of exhale as you were describing what you have been through. And I do appreciate you calling in. And hold on, let me give Anna a chance to respond.
Well, Kelly, I'm so sorry for everything that's happened to you, first of all. And you're just so eloquently describing why this is not a political decision. It's not a decision that belongs in the legislature. The choice should be made by the woman and her family and her doctor. And there's not a right or wrong answer. That is what the obstetric and gynecologic community really support, is the ability to choose and maintaining that ability to choose and not legislating the choice for women.
Kelly, is that helpful?
And again, I am so sorry.
Is that helpful, Kelly?
I just want people to think a little more about it, because I never would have thought that I would have made a decision to abort a baby, especially that late. But until you're in the circumstance, you have no idea.
I know that's a hard decision to make, but I think you have to get to where you know you made the right decision for you and your family.
Well, I don't regret the decision, because either way she was going to die.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just want people to understand the complexity. It's not simple.
Absolutely. Kelly, I really appreciate you calling in. I think
you
helped
you.
A lot
thank
of people.
Thank you for talking about it.
Indeed. And it is, I mean, and it is... It is so, first of all, hard to talk about, and it is so personal, as Kelly was telling us, and it has become so political.
And it really, you know, I don't want anyone to think that these are decisions that women make or take lightly. Kelly really so eloquently was able to show that. It's something that is a choice, and the choice is really something that I know that our Congress and college will fight to maintain for our patients.
We had heard earlier in the hour, we actually did several shows about Dr. Kermit Gosnell, but I wonder to you, Anne Honeybrink, and that's often brought up by people who oppose abortion, saying, you know, look what happened in this this abortion doctor's clinic. How do you respond to that?
I would respond that were the regulations that were in place being enforced, that never would have happened. I don't think we need to put in new regulations because we weren't able to enforce the regulations that are already in place. And it what happened with Dr. Gosnell and his patients is very unfortunate, but it is not exemplary of the issues we're talking about now. It's an example of where we need to do a better job with the regulations we have, not taking that opportunity where we didn't do what we can with what's in place and try to put more restrictions in place that make it more difficult for women and their families to get the care that they need.
And we're almost out of time here. An unfair question to ask at the end. Why do you do abortions?
Well, I will actually tell you, Marty, I don't do abortions. I did for a long time, but it was something that I personally didn't feel like I was the right person to still be doing at a point in my career. That doesn't mean I would not support a woman's right or a doctor's ability to be able to perform abortions.
Well, I thank you, Anne Honeybrink, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And she is the vice chair of the regional branch of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and is a critic of this bill that is on hold in the Pennsylvania legislature, House Bill 1948. We're going to take another short break, and then we have our fourth guest who will be joining us, Elizabeth Nash from the Guttmacher Institute, talking about this House bill and also looking at legislation across the country related to abortion. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and we can tweet us at you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been talking about House Bill 1948 on hold in the Pennsylvania legislature. If passed, and I should add the governor said he would veto it, but there could be an override. But if passed, it would ban abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy, except in cases of medical emergencies. Also ban a procedure called dilation and evacuation. Joining us now is Elizabeth Nash, and she's the Senior State Issues Associate at the Guttmacher Institute's Washington, D.C. office, joining us from NPR in Washington, D.C. And Elizabeth Nash, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And again, to our listeners, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This bill, as I said, is on hold, Elizabeth, but let's say it did pass. How would it compare to other abortion restrictions in other states across this country?
Well, the bill in Pennsylvania really is a broad landscape-changing bill. It has those two provisions that you are talking about, but it would also require women to go in person to the abortion clinic at least 24 hours in advance to get their counseling. So that means they would have to make two trips in order to get an abortion, which we know is very difficult for some women. They can't take that kind of time off of work. And they may have to travel longer distances, and they may be delayed in accessing care. So that piece of it, which isn't being discussed much, is also a huge burden on women. But for the two pieces that you were discussing, the pieces around the so-called 20-week ban and the D&E ban, basically, when you put them together, that is a major intrusion into access, and it's emblematic of what we're seeing across the country. So we're seeing states adopt these so-called 20-week bans. Right now, 12 states have these in effect. And in fact, the bill in Pennsylvania is very similar to a law that was struck down by the Ninth Circuit. The U.S. Court of Appeals struck this law down, and the U.S. Supreme Court refused to take the case. So that law in Arizona, which is so similar to the one that's being promoted in Pennsylvania, has been struck down, and the U.S. Supreme Court didn't want to take the case. So it really raises the question why this bill is being pursued when the U.S. Supreme Court wasn't going to take it.
And it raises constitutional questions, I guess, because what we're talking about viability, we're talking about the trimesters of pregnancy and changing that.
Yes. So what the Supreme Court has basically said is that a state cannot ban abortion before viability. And moreover, they talked about viability as a point in pregnancy that has to be determined by a physician, because it's a little bit different for each woman. Each pregnancy develops at a different rate. But typically, it's between 24 and 26 weeks of pregnancy. But in any case, the U.S. Supreme Court said you cannot ban abortion before that point. And if you want to place restrictions for post-viability abortions, then you must have to have exceptions to protect the woman's life and health. And this bill fails in that regard as well, because the exceptions are very narrow. It's life and a very severe health complication rather than health.
Looking over the last couple of years and looking at states in the United States, how many restrictions on abortion have been either passed or considered in legislatures?
So between 2011 and basically the beginning of this month, we've seen 309 abortion restrictions enacted in 32 states. So this isn't just a Pennsylvania issue or just a Texas issue. This is really across the country. We're seeing abortion restrictions in many cases fly through state legislatures.
And is that because critics of abortion have decided that they can make or have a bigger impact by dealing with this on a state level versus trying to get Roe v. Wade overturned or changed somehow?
Yes, pretty much. That's it. So what we've seen for the past 40 years primarily are attacks on abortion at the state level, in part because restrictions at the federal level have not, for the most part, although there are a couple of restrictions at the federal level, those efforts have not been successful. So what we see are restrictions at the state level. And we've also seen this move to adopt restrictions versus bans necessarily, like total bans on abortion, because what has become clear is that while it looks like the Supreme Court would be willing to undercut abortion rights slowly, they are not willing to completely ban abortion. So what we see at the state level is incursions into later abortion access, or incursions by requiring longer waiting periods, or limits on abortion coverage in health plans.
And how many abortion clinics or abortion providers have been shut down in recent years?
Well, you're looking at a fairly large number. We do not have exact numbers right now, but what we were looking at is that you can look state by state, where we've seen nearly 20 clinics close in Texas, where, for example, a new law went into effect and there were over 40 abortion clinics to serve 5.5 million women in Texas, and now there's less than 20. To serve those women. And we've seen similar other clinics close in states up and down, east and west, from Ohio to Tennessee to Virginia to Michigan, Pennsylvania. All over the country, we're seeing clinics close.
So does access to abortion depend on someone's zip code, for instance, or perhaps even one's financial situation?
Yes. You know, when we see these abortion restrictions become law, especially things like waiting periods or when you have to go to the clinic twice, the burden of these restrictions falls on low-income women because they're the ones who have jobs where they can't take time off of work or they can't take 2 days off very quickly at work. And if they do miss work, then they're not getting paid. And so coming up with the nearly $500 that it costs for your typical first trimester abortion can be very difficult. That's who is most impacted by these restrictions. And it does, you do start to see when abortion clinics close. Texas is a prime example where women in rural areas have fewer and fewer options, and women in cities might be delayed because there are more women going to the few remaining clinics.
More women going later in their pregnancy?
Yes, there can be. You know, we have heard of a couple of weeks of delay, And for some women, that can be very difficult because while we're talking about $500 in the first trimester for a typical abortion, by the time you reach 20 weeks, you're talking about $1,200.
That's Elizabeth Nash. She is the Senior State Issues Associate, at the Guttmacher Institute's Washington, D.C. office, the fourth of four guests in this hour of Radio Times. We have been talking about abortion restrictions, jumping off on this House Bill 1948 on hold in the Pennsylvania legislature. And you can join us, I believe, at 1-888-47. We can't. Okay, the phones apparently are down. We're trying to get them restarted. You can send us a comment, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me ask you, though, about the numbers of what we call unintended pregnancies in the United States. What percentage of pregnancies today or close to today are considered unintended?
Well, it's a sad fact, but about half of all pregnancies are considered unintended, and about a quarter of all pregnancies end in abortion. So what we're talking about is about 1 million abortions every year, which translates to about 3 in 10 women in their lifetime will have an abortion. So while we, I heard the previous segment where the woman Kelly called in.
Yes.
I bet she hasn't shared that story with very many people because most women who have abortions do not. And that, in fact, is part of some of the issue here is when people aren't able to share their story because of stigma, then it becomes difficult to talk about this reasonably.
But, and I'm picking up on this, if half of pregnancies are unintended, that does raise questions about contraception, access to contraception, use of contraception. I know when you look at countries in Europe, they have vastly fewer abortions and fewer unintended pregnancies. What can we learn? Because I would assume there is consensus that we want pregnancies to be wanted pregnancies as opposed to unwanted.
Absolutely. And you keyed on an important piece here, which is contraception access. Now, we know we have problems with healthcare access in this country, including access to family planning services. And what we've been seeing across the country is those who oppose abortion are also opposing a major provider of family planning services, and that is Planned Parenthood. And when we start to see restrictions on access to family planning, that is not helpful for women who are trying to avoid unintended pregnancy. But on top of access to family planning services, it's also talking about sex education and being able to understand the various methods of contraception, being able to negotiate contraception with your partner, and being able to have healthy relationships.
Are there, though, new procedures, perhaps even long-acting birth control, things like that, that have been effective, are available, could reduce the number of unwanted pregnancies, or other procedures, for instance, either medications or some kind of intervention?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a wide range of contraceptive methods available. Some of the most effective, however, are among the most expensive. So when you're talking about an IUD, an intrauterine device, which is the most effective method, and it is inserted into the woman, it can last up to 10 years, but it has a huge upfront cost of about $500. And while most health plans cover contraception now because of the mandate in the Affordable Care Act, there are some health plans which are not covering the full range of methods, and sometimes they do not cover this method in particular, which could be a very useful method for women.
Well, I'm also thinking about the Hobby Lobby case before the U.S. Supreme Court having to do with contraception. Is that part of what we're talking about here?
Somewhat, but in part, health plans have, in some cases, just not have been placing restrictions on access to contraception, delaying access to certain methods, especially the ones that are more expensive. They may require you to use a different method before using the chosen method that you want. So there are actually bills in states to try to require health plans to actually fulfill the mandate in the contraceptive coverage guarantee. but only really a couple of states have been moving forward with this, in part because it's very nuanced, as you probably can tell.
I know this is going back to some of the states, that Indiana being one, prohibiting abortion based on disability, whether there's a fetal abnormality or, and added to this, based on race or skin color, sex, national origin, or ancestry. Can you speak about that and how common that is?
Well, you know, certainly, you know, essentially what Indiana did was take their non-discrimination language and turn it into an abortion ban, and it's by far the broadest one of these that we have seen become law. So in addition to Indiana, there are seven states that ban abortion for purposes of gender selection, one state of those seven that also bans abortion for race, and another different state that also bans sex selection that bans abortion for genetic anomaly. And this is an issue that has cropped up over the past 5 years in particular, and it has been opposed strenuously by the groups that are really targeted here, which are women of color and Asian American women, primarily with the race and sex selection bans, because we see it as, for what it is just another way to ban abortion. It may and try to split the communities that may naturally work together, which is sort of progressive communities, along with women of color and women of Asian descent.
We have a caller who wants to stay anonymous, so go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. This is such an upsetting subject, but I just wanted to mention that an aunt of mine said that back in the 30s, she gave herself an abortion with a coat hanger. And I just wanted to say that all of this restriction is just sending women back into the dark ages to do these things to themselves that are potentially harmful and dangerous, you know, to themselves. And it's, like I said, it's just very upsetting, and that was my comment.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Elizabeth, you want to respond to that?
Yes, and I am so glad that her aunt survived.
Is that what we're facing, though, do you think?
Well, I'm very hopeful that that's not where we're headed, but we are headed to a place where it is very difficult for many women to access abortion services when they need them. And that's a complete opposite to what a public health response would be. A public health response would be to ensure women have access to all the medical services that they need, be it family planning or abortion, and that they can access them in a protected and safe environment.
Well, we have to end on that note. Elizabeth Nash, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. The Senior State Issues Associate at the Guttmacher Institute's Washington, D.C. office. And we began our conversation talking with Michael Geer, president of the Pennsylvania Family Institute. Also checked in with Angela Columbus, who covers the Pennsylvania state government for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and with Ann Honeybrink, vice chair of the regional branch of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. My apologies, we had phone problems, and we were not able to take a lot of calls during this hour of Radio Times. But you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tell us what you think of the program. Nick Kowalski, our intern for today's edition of the show. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. Radio Times produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.